This week on Writers, Inc.
We finished the first scene in The Sentinel, worked on it till we were happy. We always think of it as being a bit like a piano tuner. You know, when you see a piano tuner, like tapping on the strings and then tweaking back and forth until he's happy with the pitch. You know, that's kind of how we work. We got that first scene exactly how we wanted it to be. And I said to him, okay, so what happens next? And he just looked at me and said, well, I don't know. And that was a really disconcerting moment. Yeah, there really wasn't a plan. Then it all became real.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out, school's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
It's Kevin Tomlinson.
And it's James Blatch. Is this the self-publishing show? Am I in the wrong place?
Wait a minute. Hold up. This is J.D. Barker. We got the British invasion going on. First of all, we kind of mentioned last week that you were going to be jumping in every once in a while with the guest interview and, you know, guest hosting. So this is the first one. Welcome aboard.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here. And I guess, you know, I've got my red coat on. Look, you can't see.
There you go.
You can see. And I'm already in charge of Christine anyway, because she's still part of our family.
You are. Yeah.
In Canada. Just looking to move in and just make sure things are still in shape over on your side. Anyway, sorry. It's very nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, you're at the Frankfurt Book Fair right now, right?
Yeah, I'm in a grotty hotel room in Frankfurt, such as the glamorous life I lead. Yeah, the Frankfurt Book, I think it's the biggest book fair in the world. Someone told me that once and I never wikied to find out if it's true, but it certainly looks like it. It's in the Messe Center here in Frankfurt. It's absolutely huge. There's like eight huge halls. All the big players are there. It's a bit like the London Book Fair. You asked off air, JD, is it getting smaller? I suspect probably yes is the answer to that. I think there seems to be, I mean, certainly over the last 20 years, this type of meeting, here we are on Zoom, has taken over from a lot of the need for in-person stuff. But there's still a lot of people there and it's still a big deal. And each one of those little booths costs somebody $10,000, you know, so there's a lot of turnover in book fairs. And I guess people come along, have their meetings, sell the rights to Asia or somewhere, sort of deals that get done here. That still happens.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly love going to those things because I run into, you know, either people that I've known that I haven't seen for a while, or, you know, I tend to strike a lot of deals just, you know, running into somebody literally walking down the hall. You know, I catch somebody that I've wanted to talk to or I've talked to in the past. And like those kind of, I don't think you can replicate that with Zoom. So that's never going to go away. But yeah, I think from a publishing standpoint, here in the States anyway, a lot of the publishers I think are cutting back on their expenses, and, you know, overseas trips are definitely a big part of that. And you know, a lot of this business is, you know, it can be done, you know, over Zoom. So I think we're seeing that too.
I think you're right though. I had that conversation today that you plan meetings, but actually it's bumping into people in between those meetings are the best moments. Always, and you catch up serendipitous stuff that you sort of find areas in common when you're not looking for it. I mean, I had a couple of meetings here, but I came mainly because Elizabeth Ann West dropped me a note, and Elizabeth's become a bit of a sort of thought leader on the AI subject. Mm-hmm. I think it's, you know, it's such a huge area that we need to understand and fully evaluate and be across. And she was invited to the Frankfurt Book Fair to speak on this. And I thought, well, it's, you know, it's an hour and a half flight for me, so I'm going to come over. And we met up yesterday. I always want to say hooked up, but I think that means something different in America, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah, that'll get you in trouble.
We met up yesterday, and I listened to her speaking this morning, and she's never pulls her punches on the subject. So that was definitely worth it. I went to a couple of the other AI sessions as well, and that's the only, you know, I think that has been quite an interesting area. I'm pleased I came across for it. There was ChatGPT and a few other anthropologists who sort of look at taking a wider view of it all. So it was interesting. And hearing Elizabeth, this sort of indie person in the middle of this massively traditional conference, was a fun moment.
Was there anything on AI translations?
Yes. Yeah. Talked about translations. And there seems to be a lot of hybrid models being developed where the AI starts and then a human finishes. There's the locating. I mean, there's a whole area of translation which is not really sorted out with humans yet. You can get a mixed response from the same translators whether they've properly localized your translation and localized it, not just I think in its regional sense, but also localized it from a subject matter. So I write military stuff, and I have emails from my German readers who say you really need a pilot to read this and do that bit of translation because your translator's a generalist and doesn't know the air traffic terms, how to translate them into German. So there's talk about AI maybe even doing a slightly better job on that front if it knows what the subject is. There was a session on how you teach the AI to remember things forever. So you gradually you start with one model, but it becomes your model over time that has specific learnings. And then the human stage, which is still, I think, for the foreseeable future, going to be a part of a professional translation process, even if it starts with AI.
That makes sense. I've been using it quite a bit. I've been hiring translators, and it's funny because I get a lot of offers, and I'm using the AI to tell me whether or not the translation was done by an AI. Because like I don't speak Chinese, so I'll just copy and paste the original text in there, and I use Claude quite a bit. It seems to be my favorite. I call it a he at this point. But I will drop the original in there, I'll drop the translated copy in there, and then ask Claude, was this done by a human or an AI? And some of the things that Claude picks up on are really interesting. So like I just got one in for Forsaken yesterday, and in the sample text, the word Needful Things is in there, the store from Stephen King's store, because it's part of the novel. And Claude actually pointed out that the translator basically changed that name to, basically translated Needful Things as if it was just the words rather than a store name. And Claude pointed out that because it was a store in Stephen King's story, it should have been, printed as this. So Claude
That's handy.
recognized it, recognized it as a, something from Stephen King's story, and that it should have been a name instead of, the words. So from that standpoint, it's good. But I think you're 100% spot on. Like, I've seen the same thing. Translators are just taking the text, dumping it into an AI, and then they're running through and cleaning it up, which seems to be saving them a boatload of time, providing they do that human cleanup. So I was curious. I'm guessing, I was curious if it was coming up at the, like the bigger conferences and people are talking about it at this point.
The most controversial moment, I'm sure Elizabeth won't mind, she said it publicly, and I think she, there were press there today. But in the middle of a session this morning, she said, "So here's my take on the licensing issue of, giving your books to AI to learn them." She said, "Authors should not be paid for this. It is a service that we are providing for the general community here, and we're all going to benefit from it." And she gave an example of Google, which nobody really objected to, that swept the entire internet and every website and every bit of copyrighted information to index them and build its billion-dollar model around, which we all benefit from. And she takes the same line, almost like we pay taxes and we all use the roads, that AI is going to be ubiquitous and we should be proud that we've helped build it and that's the foundation, and not that we should be being paid for it now. So, she didn't.
People are going to be mad at me, but I actually kind of agree with that. I don't think authors should be paid.
Oh, you're dead to me.
Send your hate mail to JD Barker at
I
gmail.com.
mean, being proud doesn't pay the bills, right? In the end, we're creating products, and those products should be licensed just like anything else. If you wanted to use Mickey Mouse in something, you can't just do it. It's a product. But I mean, that being said, like all of my books were part of that original data set. Like they were listed in those databases that ChatGPT used and have since vanished. And I'm in there whether I want to be in there or not. So we should probably get into the news. We've been rambling here for a little bit.
We got news.
We have news.
Some pretty good ones too. James Patterson plans to take on Hollywood and cable news on Substack. James Patterson is expanding his creative reach with the launch of a Substack called Hungry Dogs. Patterson's Substack will include video interviews with guests like Bill Clinton, David Baldacci, and Ellen Hildebrand. These human-to-human conversations are meant to offer fresh, fun insights rather than political discussions or gotcha questions. Patterson sees Substack as a platform to express his opinions freely. His Stop the Insanity column will tackle topics like book banning and his frustrations with the Hollywood entertainment system, particularly the challenges faced by screenwriters adapting his books. Fans can also look forward to more personal content, such as seeing one of Patterson's fiction outlines, offering a glimpse into his writing process. I'm really looking forward to this, actually. I'm a big fan of Substack too. But seeing him kind of come into the venue, you know, I'm rubbing my hands together. I can't wait to kind of see the inside scoop.
I talked to him about it, and he is extremely excited. And it drives me insane because he is in his mid 70s, and this guy is running like he's a 20-year-old.
Yeah,
like I don't know how he even has the energy to do all this. But
I don't know what Substack is.
What?
Can you explain it, Kevin?
Okay, Substack. Think if you were to combine a blogging platform with a social media platform and an email newsletter management system, and you'd have Substack. You can build and grow an email list for free that you own and you can take with you if you want, using like your blog content. I love it, man. I've been doing it for a couple of years now. It's been great. I've watched my list steadily grow. And it'll grow even faster once James Patterson subscribes to me on Substack. So, James, yeah. Listen.
Well, I mean, that, you know, like you say, he's in his 70s, JD, and he's ahead of the curve on so many areas. I want to be James Patterson in many, many ways, but that's definitely in my 70s. I want to be that person who's not saying I haven't got time for new technology. I want to be the person embracing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't even know how this was on his radar, you know, like, but it's, you know, he's jumping all over it. I'm guessing the email list is probably the biggest factor, though, because I mean, we've got a podcast, we've got no idea. We see our listener numbers, but we don't have email addresses on everybody. And I'm guessing with Substack, you collect all of that, which is huge. And if you look at somebody like Patterson, you're just stepping back from it. His email list is maintained by Hachette, by Little Brown. So I don't know that he either owns that or controls that. So this would give him the ability to capture those addresses. And I doubt at this point that's a deciding factor for him. But I think for other authors that are in a similar position, it might be. You know, so we'll have to wait and see. I think if he's successful with this, I think we're going to see other people do it.
So Writers Inc. is going to Substack or what?
There you go. Yeah. I already do Wordslinger.
Kevin, do it.
Yeah, the Wordslinger podcast is hosted entirely on Substack now. And I've been thinking about porting the video version over as well. But I will say that, you know, given what I know about Patterson as a marketer, like I can absolutely see that he's doing this because it gives him direct access to that list. So he'd be turning down gold otherwise. All right, next up, an actual Taylor Swift book due November 29 as a Target exclusive. Taylor Swift is set to release the Eras Tour book on November 29th, 2024, exclusively through Target without a traditional publisher. The 256-page book, priced at $39.99 US, will feature over 500 images, including behind-the-scenes photos, performance shots, and personal reflections. Published by Taylor Swift Publications, the book will first be available in physical Target stores. There is a UPC, but no ISBN. International availability and licensing rights are still unclear.
So why does this matter?
Because she's going to become the biggest self-publisher of all time now.
Big Five Publishing tends to focus on big name authors and celebrity books, you know, often at the expense of other things. Yeah. But big names, like we had Brandon Sanderson and now Taylor Swift, who doesn't even have an ISBN. She's like, forget this whole system, are realizing they don't need a traditional publisher to take a cut of what they're making. So it just leaves me wondering, will Big Five change their model? Like chasing social media trends and celebrities, I'm not sure how much longer that's going to work.
I think it's great. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Taylor Swift from a business point of view, and an innovator and a musician. I love the concert, and I know some people love to hate on her. I think she's fantastic. And this is typical of her. It's typical of her to turn the model upside down and say, you know, she did this with her and Netflix and just did it herself with Hollywood. And she's a leader in that sense. But I do wonder if there's something bigger as well going on at the moment. I did have a conversation. Pretty well-known authors are starting to pop up in some indie forums, sometimes quite quietly, just on mailing lists. And I just wonder if some traditional published authors have had enough now. They've just seen the names of the Colleen Hoovers and the Lucy Scores. They're seeing some of the figures being banded around, and then they're looking at their 12.5% or whatever, and they're thinking, you know, I've got a name. Do I need, you know, what are they actually doing for me now? These questions are being asked, and you know, this is not going to slow down because of Taylor Swift's thing. So,
No, I've gotten a lot of phone calls over the years from authors exactly in that position. You know, they're number one New York Times bestsellers with every book that they put out, but they've got backlist titles coming back to them, and they're not sure what to do with them. They don't want to hand them over to the publisher and sign another 5, 10 year deal on these backlist titles when they know they could put them out on their own. And the only thing that's been holding them back is they don't know how to do it. You know, so that's just a learning curve. Like we were all in that same boat at one point. What really gets me about this is, and Christine brought it up, is like, why no ISBN? Because literally every backbone system behind selling books relies on that ISBN for tracking and sales and distribution and all the fun stuff, you know, for getting it from point A to point B. So I'm not sure why she would skip that. Unless it's a, you know, Target is going to be the only company ever to carry the hardcover, which, you know, I guess in that case it would make
Could be.
sense. Yeah, which is very possible.
I've always argued against the ISBN because you don't actually need it on any platform, really. Everyone's got their own version of that thing. Like Amazon's got ASIN, and Barnes Noble's got their version. But yeah, on the sort of physical distribution side, I mean, it was really just a inventory control kind of thing. That's really all anybody uses it for at this point. So,
Right, but it crosses platforms, you know. So like
yeah.
my books are with Simon and Schuster, you know, everyone has to have an ISBN, and that's how it's referred to internally through the entire process. So from cover design to uploading files, you know, the sales staff, everybody uses that number, and then it goes out to, you know, the distribution system. So like it's the only unique identifier across the board. So like
Yeah.
who knows? I've got a feeling like it's going to have an ISBN at some point, but for them to not have one to point it
It
out.
wouldn't surprise me if that is an exclusivity with Target, because you
Yeah.
think about from their point of view, the footfall into their store just to get this. I mean, I had to go into a Target a couple of years ago to buy my daughter a special edition vinyl of
Yeah.
a Taylor Swift thing. And I mean, I see the timing of this is terrible. My daughters are going to tell me to stay in Vegas after the conference this year so I can
Well,
try not to buy
if
this.
there's no Target in UK.
No Target in the UK. But
Oh.
they would have done the figures on this. They know how much it's worth them, somebody entering the store. They don't just buy that one product. And so they wouldn't surprise me if they're paying a lot towards this for the exclusivity. And it doesn't need an ISBN because it's just a product on the shelf in Target.
Well, does this mean that Target is possibly getting into publishing as a big box
I mean,
store?
it's not,
I
they might not even
mean,
see it as publishing. It's an item that they're buying. It's going
right.
to go on their shelves.
Yeah, that's
And
true.
they're known for these sort of exclusive deals too. Like they have a whole deal with like Chip and Joanna Gaines for like their home stuff, home decor and all that sort of thing. So they've done this sort of thing before on in different areas of their store. So I don't really see it as all that unusual. It's just only odd because it's a book, But yeah, I agree with James. I think they see it as a product, not a,
Yeah.
not
And that
necessarily a
price
book.
too, $39.99 for a coffee table book, it's essentially a coffee table book, is
Yeah.
ridiculously cheap compared to other coffee table books. Like,
Yeah.
yeah, I agree with you, James. Very, very smart businesswoman. Good for her. It's awesome.
Yeah.
All right, final story. TikTok's owner already publishes digital books. Now it's moving on into print. ByteDance, the parent company of TikTok, is expanding its publishing venture, Eighth Note Press, by moving into physical book publishing. In collaboration with independent publisher Zando, the imprint plans to release 10 to 15 print books annually, focusing on popular genres among millennial and Gen Z readers, such as romance, romanticy, and young adult fiction. The expansion will allow Eighth Note Press to better cater to readers who still prefer physical books, a format that remains dominant in these genres, especially within the growing book talk community. The collaboration also reflects a strategic move by Eighth Note Press to focus on what's trending online and to acquire books that resonate with the active social media discussions, particularly on TikTok, where physical books play a significant role in influencer content creation.
Are you guys selling any books on TikTok? No.
No.
I do a few when I get the time to concentrate on it. I do shift a few, but I
Yeah.
obviously just use it for marketing and they go to Amazon to buy it. I don't use TikTok shop. I do kind of feel TikTok's, it feels like going off in a lot of different ways, a lot of different tangents. I mean, TikTok shop is now dominating the platform. And it's quite a poor user experience now when you can get an advert followed by a TikTok shop, followed by a TikTok shop, and you think, where's the organic content disappearing? They're really going down that hole. I just don't know if they're don't know, they've built, I don't know if they're completely sure about what they are and what they're going to be in the future. And there's so many things starting each month in the
Yeah.
TikTok camp.
It sounds kind of like what happened with Etsy, with, you know, suddenly there was a shift when they started allowing, businesses and companies that were not independent creators to come in. Suddenly the whole ecosystem shifted. And now, you know, this store that's always been known to focus on, you know, artisanal indie created stuff, and suddenly you can't find that stuff. You're inundated with the garbage that's being, you know, mass produced by someone else. And I think TikTok is kind of facing a similar problem. I think it's going to become less about the content, the original content, and more about just selling you on whatever's hot.
Yeah. What's interesting though for me about this is those BookTok books that people were going to traditional stores and publishers to buy are now going to be put out through TikTok. So again, I'm looking at this big five publishing model chasing these social media trends, and I don't know that that's going to keep working for them moving forward.
Yeah.
Well, there's not many books, is it 10 to 15 a year? But
my biggest hang up with it is you can't do pre-orders, you know, so you can put your book in the TikTok shop and you can create all the links, and they actually, they tie into the other systems very well. Like the back end for TikTok for me ties directly to Simon & Schuster for distribution. So those orders flow through. I don't even see them. And they've got a plugin for Shopify and a bunch of other ones. So from the back end, it works great, but you can't do pre-orders. From what I've seen, because you can also create affiliate deals. So if somebody talks about your book, they can put a link directly in that video. You know, somebody clicks on that video, they can buy the book directly from the video that just sold it to them. Then everybody gets paid. So like that whole side of it seems to work really well. But you know, for books, you have to have a pre-order. Like that's huge, at least for me. Like I think it's important.
Yeah, I know 10 to 15 books isn't a lot, but I'm just thinking about, you know, with their algorithms, what are they going to be promoting? It's going to be their own books, right? I would imagine.
Oh, yeah, of course. Right. Yeah.
Well, that's it for this week's news, everybody.
JD, who is up this week?
This week, we've got Andrew Child coming back. Together with his brother Lee, they're the number one New York Times bestselling authors of the Jack Reacher books, and their latest is called In Too Deep, which releases October 24th. Here he is, Andrew Child.
Andrew Child, welcome back to the show. This is your third appearance. We're very, very grateful that you've given us your time.
James, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Now, this is a weird situation because you've been here, you're an old hand at this show. This is my debut, so you'll have to show me the ropes as we go along. Listen, we are here to talk about Jack Reacher, I think one of the great fictional characters of our time. Not just in literary, he's appeared in so many different guises. The new book, I mean, tell me how many Reacher books are out. What number is this now?
Well, this one is going to be number 29, which is incredible. I remember when the series started all those years ago. I don't think anybody, certainly Leah and I, never imagined that it would still be going 29 years later.
Yeah, fantastic. And it's got a gripping and compelling beginning. So just describe the book. It's called In Too Deep. Got a copy in my hand. I'm about a third of the way through, so no spoilers, please. But I do want you to talk about the beginning, and we're going to focus on that a bit.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Yeah, what happens in the beginning of this one is Reacher wakes up. Well, he doesn't really wake up because he wasn't asleep. He was unconscious. He'd been knocked unconscious in a car accident. His wrist had also been broken in that accident. So he regains consciousness, and he finds that he's shackled to a metal table in a pitch dark room. No idea what's happened. No idea how he got there. So he is obviously very motivated to find out. Somebody comes into the room, switches on the light, starts asking Reacher questions. And turns out that wasn't the best approach because Reacher is not in a good mood. And that guy's day does not go very well.
It does not. So I want to, first of all, say I am a fan of Reacher. And I think I read a lot of these books. I write thrillers, so I read a lot of the big names who write and sell lots of books. And somebody or other, one of your cover quotes, probably Karen Salter, said, accept no substitutes. And I agree with that. I think there's something about Reacher. It's very, it's a simply addictive story from the word go. Lee obviously started this. You've got your own background in writing thrillers. How much pressure do the two of you feel, book 29, with those kind of plaudits? And it's not uncommon to hear people talking about your Reacher books like that.
Well, thank you. And I mean, there is an enormous amount of pressure. I think it comes differently for the two of us because for him, it was a much slower build because, of course, when the first Reacher came out all those years ago, no one knew anything about it. No one had any expectations. So he was able to build and build and build gradually over the years. And then when it came time for me to join him in the writing, I felt like a little bit like, you know, if you're at an airport and they have those escalator things, but that just travel horizontally, you know, to whisk you through the terminals that much faster. I felt like I was leaping straight onto one of those that was going at 100 miles an hour and had to be, you know, really struggle to you know, not fall over, make sure I found my feet. So it was, you know, it's a big responsibility because there are so many Reacher fans around the world. And what I do is I go back to some advice that Lee gave me when I first started writing. He said to me, you've got to remember the top three priorities are the readers, and the readers. You know, it's very easy to get sidetracked with industry stuff, you know, with what your fellow authors are thinking, what people at the publishing houses, what their opinions are, what the reviewers think, what the promoters think. But the only thing that actually matters is what the readers think and what the readers want. And, you know, I was the original Jack Reacher fan. I was the first person in the world to read a Reacher book. You know, I read Killing Floor when it was still written in pencil. So, you know, because I am first and foremost a Reacher fan, you know, I think I'm fairly clued into what Reacher fans want. So, you know, my focus is rather than worry about the pressure, try to channel it into doing the best job that I can to give the readers what they want.
In the last book, you talked about how you used to try and have a different voice from Lee when as a brother writing in the same genre, and now you've got to kind of reverse that and be the same voice. But actually, I do wonder if there's got to be, you can't be identical characters. There's got to be some complementary aspect of you coming into Reacher. Do you feel that's happening?
Yes, I think that, you know, there's no point in just trying to copy what's already been done. I think it's important not to make fundamental changes because there are things about Reacher and about the way that the books work that people love. So the last thing I want to do is change those things and make the experience of reading a Reacher book less enjoyable. But, you know, you talked at the beginning about, you know, the books being grabbing you and propelling you through the story. And that's not an accident. You know, that comes about because of the way that the specific word choices and sentence structures and paragraph structures work. So, part of the thing about the voice is trying to keep, really, it's what lies below the voice. It's the structure that the narratives follow. And, you know, they work by, in a way, posing a question at the beginning. People are hardwired to want the answer to a question if one is either asked or implied. So the start of this book, you know, there are plenty of implied questions. How did Reacher get in that room? What happened to him? Who did this to him? What is he going to do about it? So, you know, you hook people in, and then you use the, you know, it sounds pretentious, but you use the prose to not only grab them, but keep hold of them and not let them go until they get to the end. So the voice is, it's more than just an aesthetic thing. It's actually a very functional, mechanical thing. And it's the thing that makes the books work in the distinctive way that they do.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, there's actually not a huge amount of scope for you being individual here. You have to make the mechanics of the book work, whichever one of you is writing.
Yeah, the mechanics have to work. We know that the readers loved Lee's voice, the way that that the words flowed on the page. So I want to try to continue with that. But there is still, you know, our father was from Ireland, so he could get away with this kind of thing. He always used to say the key was to come up with something that was the same, only different. So, you know, you want to have all of the same elements that the people love and expect. You know, there's a bargain involved, isn't there? People are going to go to the bookstore and hand over their hard-earned money and in return walk away with a Reacher book. They have expectations of what that book is going to be. So we have to match those expectations, hopefully exceed them. And Lee described it once in a way I thought was great. He described it as a little bit like, you know, if you watch the Winter Olympics when they have the ice dancing competition, competitions. So if you enter one of those competitions, there are certain routines, certain moves, certain things that have to be included in order for you to get the marks for technical merit. But in order to make it interesting, in order for people to want to watch your routine, you have to put them together in a different, fresh, interesting, unique way. And I think that's a really good metaphor for writing a thriller, because there are certain things that people expect. You know, they expect Reacher to be confronted with a puzzle that he has to solve. They expect Reacher to be confronted by a villain who is vile and disgusting so that they can look forward to Reacher vanquishing this guy. Now, the exact nature of that puzzle and the nature of that villain and how Reacher gets to the answer at the core of everything and how Reacher defeats the bad guy, all of those things not only can be changed, but should be changed, because you don't want this exactly the same thing every time. But I think if we produced a Reacher book with no puzzle for him to solve or no villain for him to defeat, it wouldn't be satisfying. So, you know, there are certain elements that must be maintained. There are certain ingredients that have to always be added to the stew. But, you know, the overall flavor can still be completely different at the end. So I want to do things that are different, as long as they fit within the overall expectation of the reader. And when we started, when we did the first book together, The Sentinel, you know, Lee was famous for not planning, not outlining, just coming up with a great opening to the book and then seeing where things lead. And with The Sentinel, it was slightly different, because he said to me, that was the first one when we worked together, he said, "Andrew, what I want you to do is nudge Reacher forward a little bit in terms of the technology," because Reacher had actually originally been reasonably tech savvy. If you think back to Persuader, which was the seventh book in the series, Reacher at one point early on, no spoilers in case people haven't read that one, he opens a secret compartment in the heel of his shoe and pulls out a little device that is able to send emails. So all of those years ago, you know, 22 years ago, Reacher was able to use a concealed device to send essentially an email. And then for some reason, Lee just sort of exaggerated and exaggerated and exaggerated Reacher's dislike of technology to the point that he realized he'd gone too far and it needed to be corrected. And so he said to me, that was the first thing that was really the only thing he wanted me to consciously do when we were working together on The Sentinel. And I said, I'm more than happy to do that, but there's something that I want to do as well, which is that I noticed that in the early Reacher books, Reacher was funny, he was sarcastic, he was witty. And he used that wit as another weapon. It was another string to his bow. You know, we know that Reacher is really strong and really good at fighting and really resourceful and good at solving puzzles. But he's also, in those earlier books, capable of destroying people verbally. There was one, it was the one that's called The Visitor in the UK, where there's a sequence where Reacher is driving in a car with a woman who turns out not to be a very nice character. And Reacher just rips her to pieces. And I remember laughing out loud reading that when that book came out. And I wanted to go back. That had been lost, I felt, and I wanted to bring that back. So we did sort of realign a little bit when we did that first one together. And from there, we have, I think we got back on the right track with those. And that's, you know, that's the direction we're going to continue. But, you know, hopefully the journey that he's on, he'll visit plenty of interesting places along the way and have lots of interesting experiences so that people want to keep coming back every year for the new one.
Yeah. And that sort of answers my previous question as to what you've brought to it. And that's an interesting answer that you know, you're a fan of Reacher, and there's bits of Reacher that you feel probably have been a bit lost over the way. And that's an opportunity for you to bring it back. And I was going to ask you about the 1st of September. Famously, your brother got fired from Granada TV here in the UK and sat down on the 1st of September and wrote a book, and that was the beginning of the rest of his life. And he subsequently sits down on the 1st of September every year and begins the book without apparently plotting. And you mentioned that that's had to change a little bit with the two of you working together.
We've kept to the core of that tradition. We still start on September 1st, and we, you know, I kind of experimented. I used to, when I was writing my own books, I was never a huge outliner, but I did like to have some idea of where I was going and where I was going to end up. Slightly more so in the Cooper Devereaux books that I did, because they had a feature of those books was that they each had three storylines that had to intertwine and then merge at the end. And I didn't want there to ever be consecutive chapters that covered the same storyline. So that needed more planning to make sure that you didn't accidentally roll one into the other. So I planned those a little more. But so when we started The Sentinel, I was thinking to myself, you know, he's probably exaggerating. He probably does have a bit more of a plan than he lets on. So I should probably have one too. So I did try to sketch out the next few scenes two or three times. I put quite a lot of time and effort into it. And what I found was every single time it was a waste, because when you got to that part in the story, you just realized, no, Reacher wouldn't do that. The bad guy wouldn't do that. You have to make, even though it's fiction and there's obviously a degree of exaggeration, because in real life, most people don't go around constantly fighting and killing bad guys and solving puzzles and so on. But you have to make it, I think, an absolute critical component of a thriller that people are going to enjoy, is that every decision that the major characters make is not only plausible and believable, but it's not overly complicated. You know, there's a litmus test for me in thrillers, which is if you reach a point where a character makes a decision and you say, yeah, but why did he not just phone the police? You know, guys walk, you know, he finds a dead body in an alley. You know, if he then decides to get involved with finding out why that body is there, who killed the person, who he was, why, you have to really justify that, because in real life, no one's doing that. In real life, people are pulling out their mobile phones and dialing 999 or 911 or whatever. They're not going to get involved. And so you have to always justify. And what I found was that the more I tried to project forward in the story, as I reached those points, the less realistic and the less believable the decisions were. And so in the end, I abandoned it and just had to work with his method. And it was a real awakening for me, because we, like I said, I secretly suspected that he did plan more than he let on. And there was, we finished the first scene in The Sentinel, worked on it till we were happy. We always think of it as being a bit like a piano tuner. You know, when you see a piano tuner, like tapping on the strings and then tweaking back and forth until he's happy with the pitch. You know, that's kind of how we work. We got that first scene exactly how we wanted it to be. And I said to him, okay, so what happens next? And he just looked at me and said, well, I don't know. And that was a really disconcerting moment. Yeah, there really wasn't a plan. Then it all became real. But there's a way, and, you know, again, I don't want it to sound too sort of pretentious, but, you know, I think a feature of the Reacher books is the writing comes across as being kind of confident. You know, there's a confidence to the narrative that pulls you through. And if you are walking a tightrope with no safety net, you know, the safety net being a plan that you can always fall back on. A lot of people I know who do outline say they like it, because if they get up in the morning and they're not feeling very inspired that day, it doesn't matter, because they can just look at the plan and that'll tell them what they have to do that day. If you don't have a plan or a safety net, you have to just press on to the other side with the risk of falling, which means you have to be very confident in the way that you write. And I think that that comes across in the way that you read. And I think that it adds to the experience. I think it makes it's part of what makes the books distinctive.
Yeah. And there is a confidence needed for that. But do you think it's changed your writing? Are you going to go back to your books? You know, some of your series, I think, probably aren't finished, are they? And
that's right, they're not. And I would love to, you know, there's definitely more to come on those. The only issue there is finding the time. But, you know, I absolutely will. And it will be a very interesting challenge, because what I've found in the past is, you know, it's a little bit like, I don't know how you were, you know, at school playing football, things like that. But my problem with that sort of thing was, in my mind, you know, I'd be on the football pitch, the ball would be at my feet, the goal would be at my mercy. In my mind, I could see my foot kicking the ball arrowing into the top corner. But when I tried to actually execute that, you know, I'd probably fall over and, you know, trip over on the ball, and it would be a disaster. So what I often find is that making the switch between what you can see in your head and what happens in real life sometimes is more difficult than you think it's going to be, even to the point that I wrote my first three books, I think, in the first person. the way the story for the fourth book was going to work required it to be third person. And I remember thinking, oh, well, that can't be too hard. I'll easily be able to change gear. And it was much more difficult than I thought. It took me much longer to make the switch in a way that actually was satisfactory and worked the way I wanted it to work. And it was the same when I started working with Lee. You know, as you mentioned, I did have this conundrum because I had consciously tried so very hard over 9 books to not sound like I was a reflection of my brother. And then, of course, now I needed to turn 180 degrees and sound like him. I thought, okay, well, it's not going to be too hard. I just have to do the thing that I was, you know, trying to avoid. And again, it took longer doing the Sentinel to get this. I had to rewrite much more than I'd ever had to do before, because the story was going in the right direction and the characters were doing the right things, but it just didn't sound right. It didn't flow right. So I had to keep rewriting and rewriting. And that's improved now. I can get to where I wanted it to be much more quickly. So it's a more efficient process than it was. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens when I switch back, if I decide to write another janitor book, for example, which I would really love to do. How long will it take me to change mental gear and, you know, actually start sounding like, you know, the person who wrote the janitor books as opposed to the person who writes the Reacher books?
Yeah. You said you went back over the books and there were bits of the Reacher character that you wanted to bring out again, and Lee did as well, wanted to move on a little bit. But how much influence, the fact that you're writing a character that has appeared on TV and in cinema as well, at some point in your mind, does that become a bit confusing, though, what Tom Cruise brought to the character, what Alan Ritchson isn't in the TV series? Is it hard? I mean, I think Alan Ritchson is superb, by the way. And is it hard to shift that and go back to your literary Jack Reacher and not be influenced, or do you let it come in?
Well, you know, I agree. I think Alan's doing an amazing job with the TV. I love sitting down to watch it. But in my mind, it's a completely different thing, you know. Lee and I, we're both book people. It's always been about the books. The books come first, second, and third. TV and movies and anything else are great, but they are separate, different things. And, you know, I've lived with Reacher now. So this is the 29th book. So I've lived with Reacher for 30 years now. You know, he was always the one writing them and with his name on the cover. But we always, right from the beginning, you know, I was the first one to read that book. I was the first one to give him feedback on it. We wrote, you know, we would always talk about Reacher. What would Reacher do here? What would Reacher do there? Difference now is I just have to write it down as opposed to when we just talked about it. But we, you know, we lived with him as a kind of imaginary extra brother for 30 years. So, you know, a movie which is 90 minutes or even a TV show which is a few hours, you know, they're too small a phenomenon in contrast to really knock the books off track. And, you know, for us, as I said, it's the books that come first anyway. You know, the TV, the people, that's why I don't write the TV show or have anything to do with the TV show. I don't know how to do that. You know, that's not my strength. And so the people who do know how to do that and who are really good at it are the ones who make the TV shows. So I think, you know, not only is it not my skill set, it's not my primary focus either. So I don't believe that the TV or the movies has really influenced me at all. Although, you know, it's very funny when, I don't know if you get this, but you know, when one of your books is coming out and often the publicity people will pull a quote from the book and put it on social media or something. And, you know, you open your phone and there are some words that you wrote appearing on the screen. You know, how did they get there? I always find that really weird. And in the second season of the TV, there were a couple of bits that I recognized from The Secret that showed up in the show. And so things like that, it's very, you know, very enjoyable and very pleasing to come across those. But I don't think I've ever written a single scene or even a line of dialogue with a view to how it would appear on the screen. You know, other people know how to take it from the page to the screen. So I just focus on putting it on the page and don't go any further.
Yeah. And I was thinking one of the things that makes books unfilmable is when an author's, I mean, if you're a producer of a of a TV series or film, you recognize straight away how expensive it would be if somebody suddenly appeared in Japan, or then they went off and became a NASA astronaut for a year and then came back. But Richard is always somebody who's in a close-knit environment, isn't he? You don't have to try at that. That lends itself to a TV episode where everything takes place in a fairly small, confined area, which I love about it as well.
Yeah, it does. It gives you that really compelling sense of almost claustrophobia because you're locked into that one locale. But the other thing about, you know, what makes a book easy or difficult to adapt, and I think the Reacher books are actually much harder to adapt than they appear, because people will finish a Reacher book and they'll walk away with memories of, you know, the fight scenes and all of the, you know, the drama and everything. But the way the Reacher books work, really, so much of it is Reacher figuring out the problems. It's Reacher reaching conclusions or reflecting on aspects that he's seen. And that is actually really difficult to translate. So I think the people who do that, the showrunners and the script writers for the TV, are doing an amazing job, because what we hear from readers a lot is that their favorite thing is to think along with Reacher. You know, they're presented with this insurmountable problem, and Reacher peels away the layers one after the other until finally he gets to the heart of the thing. And they love that. They love stepping along with him. And because that's mainly taking place in his head, how do you put that on the screen? So I think that was not only the biggest problem for the movies, because they just didn't have the time to do it. You know, 90 usable minutes in a movie, you don't have time to go step by step by step by step. So that was a very difficult thing. They do have the time with the streaming TV, which is why Lee was so happy when it became an option to do that. But it is also very difficult for the people who do the adaptation to get that part right. And that is one of the best parts about watching them, is that they do get it right. You can see Reacher working the problem through to its conclusion. So that's something that's not only really difficult to do in terms of the translation, but also something that makes the TV just an inherently better medium than the movies were.
Yeah, and I think they've announced season 3. Are they not going into production?
It's actually complete. It's ready to go. It's just I don't know when it will air, when it will stream. But yeah, it is complete, all done, ready to go. So we're just waiting to hear from Amazon when it's going to be available on Prime. So I'm hoping soon, because I can't wait to see it. But I don't have any inside info on that, I'm afraid.
Yeah, us too. Is Jack Reacher a superhero, do you think, in the sense that Spider-Man was like the nerd's dream, and that he suddenly had powers, he could take on all the bullies and the bad people around him and didn't have to be put upon? And with Reacher, I sort of feel I get the same enjoyment from the books, because he can sort things out on your behalf type thing.
Yeah, the on your behalf thing is absolutely key. And I wouldn't necessarily say superhero, but I would certainly say he is a version of an eternal archetype of a character. You know, he's essentially the originally 20th, now 21st century version of the knight errant. You know, the character that we've seen everywhere in every culture, every continent, every time period, right back probably to ancient Greece. You know, you had the Ronin in Japan, you had all of those different, you had the cowboys in the United States, all of these different traditions that all share the common theme of a regular person is in trouble, a mysterious stranger arrives, solves the problem, and leaves. And the leaving part is actually, I think, the most important, because if you think about it in Reacher terms, imagine, you know, Reacher arrives in the town, fixes the problem, and then moves in next door to the person who he'd helped. What is that person going to do? Do they have to then mow Reacher's lawn for the rest of their life? You know, do they have to bring him coffee every morning? You know, it would just completely change the dynamic. And so it's not just the arriving and the fixing of the problem that makes it so critical. It's the leaving. And it just somehow taps into this need. You know, humans are interesting. We have a need for stories that no other animals have. And we have evidently this desire for somebody to just come in, take care of the problem that you can't deal with, and then leave. And, you know, it varies, you know, the scope of the problem and the means required to fix it vary, but the point of it is the same, because think of our everyday lives. We all have frustrations. We all face things that are upsetting or annoying that we want to be able to do something about. You know, a boss at work who doesn't treat you right. You see someone on the street being horrible to somebody. You know, you want to intervene, but you can't because, you know, maybe you're not that good at fighting, or maybe you are, but then you know that then you'd go to jail, or, you know, all of the things that stop us in real life from doing the things that really we would love to be able to do. We can't do those things, but here's Reacher on the page doing them for us. And so I think that's the thing that you know, as you said, on your behalf, you know, taking care of this thing on your behalf. And not only that, but again, what's so unlike real life is that you can get the right outcome at the end. You know, the rich, powerful guy doesn't get to ride roughshod over the little guy. He can in real life, but not when Reacher's involved. You know, Reacher is going to make sure that right prevails come what may. And that is really, really satisfying too.
And I think you do tread the right balance in terms of his sadism, which is not the right word because he's not sadistic, but there is something about Reacher that he looks forward to that moment when the guy's holding a gun to him and he sort of calmly says to him, I really wish you'd put that gun down and this is going to end up really bad for you. And you kind of know Reacher's looking forward to that bit, but without being deliberately sadistic.
Yeah, he's not deliberately sadistic. But, you know, there is an absolute moral code to Reacher, you know, and in the books it stems back to his mother, you know, who was conscious that her kid was bigger than all the other kids and always made him promise that he would give the bad guy the chance to walk away. And so we still do that to this day. You know, Reacher will confront this guy. There is that delicious sense of looking forward to the bad guy getting his justified comeuppance. But Reacher will always say, just as you said there, you know, put the gun down, walk away while you still can. And if the guy chooses not to, you know, it becomes a very sort of black and white, you know, very binary, you know, if the person is good or if they take the opportunity to walk away that Reacher gives them, they will be absolutely fine. If they are bad and they refuse to walk away, then they're basically dead. You know, there's no in between, you know, and so it does. I mean, the reader, it's a satisfying journey for the reader. And I guess that shows a little bit in Reacher too, because, you know, who doesn't enjoy putting right a wrong?
Yeah, absolutely. As you say, that happens in the opening scene. And the opening scene, I think, does stand out in this book. It's that moment that thriller writers always told at some point in the book, the long dark night of the soul, you've got to back your hero into a corner where it's seemingly impossible, it's absolutely hopeless, all, and you literally open page one like that, which is, I think it's a great writing exercise to try that.
Yeah, I just jump right in, and you know, part of it is exactly what you just described, but the other part of it that motivated me was the fact that, you know, we know what Reacher is capable of. You know, we know how big, strong, clever, capable he is. And so you have to find super challenging situations for him, because, you know, if it is a version of making the stakes high enough, isn't it? Because, you know, if it was just that, you know, someone had, you know, told him to sit in a chair in the corner, you know, that's not really going to work with Reacher. So you have to really, you know, really pile onto him to challenge him sufficiently to make the journey of him escaping from the predicament and putting right the wrongs, to make it, you know, seem enjoyable enough and make it worth his time.
Well, Andrew, I think it's a great partnership, you and your brother. I did meet your brother once in New York. I don't think I've met a more laconic figure than, you know, cigarettes in his hand and just laid back. You seem slightly different from him, which sort of led to my question earlier about whether there were complementary elements going into it. But I think we talked about that and you explained it very well in terms of bringing something else out, but all about the mechanics of the book. So I do hope you go back to your books as well, because I think that voice shouldn't be lost.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. And I absolutely intend to. So let's hope that I can come back and we can talk about those books one day.
Yeah, definitely. And I've just noticed it's October the 1st. So without letting any secrets out, presumably you are in the midst of it all.
Absolutely, yeah. The boulder has been pushed back up the hill. As we always do, started on September 1st. So we're exactly 1 month into the process.
Brilliant. Well, we look forward to that. Andrew, thank you so much for coming on again.
James, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for your time.
There you go. There's Andrew Child, a really fun interview, and he was very patient because we had some technicals as well, so I want to thank him for that. I think a couple of things came out of it for me. We talked a lot about rhythm in the book, and obviously with Andrew Child, you know, we've spoken to him a couple of times before on the show, so we've asked those questions about writing in your own voice and then suddenly having to switch and write in your brother's voice, which he was studiously avoiding doing because he didn't want to be, you know, seen to be his brother's, his own writer. And now he is writing that voice. But actually what he talked about was not so much his brother's voice, but the timbre of the Reacher novel, which has its own pace, its own rhythm, its own way of working. And it was interesting to hear him talk about stuff that he loved about Reacher that he realized actually in the last 8 books hadn't really been there, but he was able to bring back, and his brother was happy with that aspects of Reacher. So I don't know whether we think about rhythm enough. We talk about our own writing style, but I thought from a thriller writer point of view, and this probably goes across all genres, that's actually a really good way of thinking about your book when you're thinking about it as a whole, that rhythm and pace and those beats.
See, I've got a weird take on this because I'm autistic. And one of the things that I discovered years back is that I could mimic the styles of other authors. So if I read just a little bit, a couple of chapters, I could pick up on their vocabulary, their cadence, and their rhythm, and basically mimic that and keep going. So I think that's what Andrew is basically trying to do. And he's doing it well. And he's analyzing every one of these Reacher books and, like, you know, pointing out something like that. I mean, as a reader, I don't think they pick up on that at all. It's a subconscious thing. Like, you don't notice that it's actually there. But it is. And it's funny because if you read, you know, like just one of the early Lee Child books and then jump to like the first one that Andrew wrote with Lee, you can see distinct differences between it. But if you read the most recent one, a lot of those differences have gone away. So he is melding into his brother's style and bringing that stuff back.
I'm fascinated by the fact that they were able to pull this off, though. Like, I love my brother, but there's no way I could trust him to pick up my franchise and write it. I don't think I know anybody that I'd feel comfortable handing it off to. Do any of you know someone that you'd be comfortable handing your work to carry on?
I think it'd be hard. I mean, I didn't ask him any personal questions about his sort of relationship with his brother, and I should have done, but it was half an hour and we talked about the book a lot, and I wasn't sure how he'd respond to those anyway. But I am interested in that aspect of it, of that trust and whether it's brought them together a little bit, which seems like a nice thing, doesn't it? They actually live quite close to each other now. He's turning me off air, but I don't know. I mean, I actually wouldn't. I'm not in a position, I don't write enough books, but I'm not in a position where I particularly want to write with somebody else or have somebody else write my books, because one of the number one reasons I write books is because I enjoy the writing process and producing books and being really proud of them afterwards. And you're in a different world from me, JD, the sort of the volume that you produce and the industry that JD Barker is. And I can see how that works for you as an industry, but where I am with my writing, maybe I think Christine and Kevin, well, you are a co-writer, of course, Christine and Kevin, maybe the same as me. Writing is why we do it. You know, for that reason.
Yeah. I mean, I can't think of anybody I'd want to hand it off in like today's world, but like, you know, my daughter is 7 now. And she's writing, you know, at you know, a 7-year-old level, but like in school, they teach them how to create a beginning, middle, and end. They illustrate their own books. You know, the beginning, middle, and end thing, like I know plenty of adult authors that can't figure that part out. But like she's got this interest in it. And like, I can almost see that, you know, 10, 15 years down the road where, you know, she might be able to continue one of my storylines if she's still into it. You know, for all I know, she might want to become an astronaut or a veterinarian or one of the other things on her top 10 list. But she's seeing it. And it's funny because like the other day, she realized that, you know, I'm kind of well known, you know, like I'm not famous or anything, but in her eyes, I am. And like she went to the post office and like I had a book that somebody had sent me, and the post office person brought up that I get a lot of books, and she told the post office person that's because my dad's a famous writer, which, you know, that like hit me really, really in the heart. But then she came home and she asked me if it was true. And I just turned to the Amazon Alexa and asked who is J.D. Barker, and she told her. So that kind of reinforced it. But like I can see her eyes like lighting up, you know, like at the idea of like all the books behind me being written by her dad and her wanting to do that. So it would be very cool to write with my kid at some point, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
That would be nice. The other thing we talked about, but I think is a little bit different with this book, was the opening chapter, the opening few sentences. So if we think about the traditional way of writing a novel, the Save the Cat or, you know, Story Grid or whatever, you always, the traditional way is to start with normal life and then something happens that turns everything upside down, right? The inciting incident. Whereas this starts almost in the middle of a story, yeah, which I think you can only do when you've got someone with reach and you kind of know all the normal life, what normal life looks like. So the opening three sentences are that point that you would normally put right in the middle of the interview, middle of the book, where he's in a hopeless situation with no way out. And I liked that. And it moves really quickly at the beginning. It was a great first couple of chapters.
That's actually kind of an old school rule of start in the middle of the action, which I, you know, oddly, I don't think I see very often. But yeah, I love it when I can think of doing it, when I think about doing it, I love to start in the middle like that. That's how you get that tempo going. Yeah.
Have you ever done that, Kevin? Like thought that was maybe your climax, but then started your book there instead? I've heard that advice sometimes, but I don't think they're like start at the max and then go from there. Have you done that?
I've done something like that, sort of retroactively, because I did it. It's kind of like a flashback. Or a flash forward, I guess, to start the book, and then you go back and you tell the story leading up to that. I've done that a few times. JD made me add some minor action, but some action to start our book that I think is well placed.
Well, that used to be one of my go-to tools when I was a ghostwriter and a book doctor. You know, a lot of times somebody would turn in a book, and like I think as authors, we feel like it's necessary to write a story organically and literally, you know, like this happens and this happens, this happens, this happens. But a lot of times when you look back at it, if you can be objective about it, it makes sense to grab this piece from maybe the third act and throw it at the beginning to spur all the action. For me, it always reminds me of two movies. Like any Indiana Jones movie always starts with that action. And if you think about it, like I don't think Indiana Jones would have worked if they didn't have that opening action sequence.
Yeah.
Because it would have started off as a fairly boring storyline. So
in a university, yeah,
they get the adrenaline going, you know, they get you pumped up, and then you know you're willing to settle back and deal with that other portion. And there's a John Travolta movie in that, you know, with Halle Berry, and the name escapes me, but they basically do the same thing. They start and it's like in the middle of a bank heist, like the opening scene, and that's really like three quarters through the movie. And then they jump back to the beginning, and for the same reason, because they have to give you that backstory, but they don't want to lose that audience at the get-go. So that's one of the reasons why I love Scrivener, because you can write all these scenes in Scrivener. You can write them, you know, as they happen in order, and then you can go through and shuffle them all up and come up with something that makes sense.
Yeah, I fully agree with that. Yeah, that's how I use Scrivener. It's a very, I love the whole nonlinear aspect of it, even though I probably don't utilize it nearly as much as I should, but just having that ability, it has come in real handy, especially in as I'm editing. Because I'll be reading along and realize, oh, you know, later I wrote a scene and it would actually fit better here, you know, like, so I'm able to just quickly grab it. I've tried doing that in Microsoft Word over the years. And if you're in Word on a Windows computer, it actually has the ability to let you grab, like if you're using the Word's chapter headings, you can actually use, there's a little binder type thing that you can open and you can move your chapters that way. But if you're doing it on Mac, you don't have that option. So Scrivener is still superior.
Scrivener is a great tool. I can't write in Word anymore. I did my first novel in Word and it was 136,000 words, and it would take 10 minutes to load it.
Yeah.
You know, so the page is loading at the bottom, and no, I'm not doing that again.
Did you try formatting it when you were writing in Word? Were you trying to format the book as well?
I actually moved to Scrivener in my rewrite. So that was my first draft and I rewrote it in Scrivener. So I've never actually done that. In fact, it annoys me that when you get to the editor stage, the editors are a little bit set in their ways and they want it back in Word, Times New Roman, double space, 12 points. And so suddenly you're working Word again, which is slightly irritating. I guess Atticus gets around that, doesn't it? I haven't used Atticus, but it's supposed to be.
Atticus was like just in my head just now, because like they need to get to that. Like I know that was one of the things that they wanted to create and allow that, you know, organic editing, like being able to share and like all that stuff. And like, it's just not there from a feature set standpoint. But once they get that, I think I can see the industry shifting, because nobody likes those Word documents. Yeah, you talk to an editor and they've got 10 versions of the same book, like there's no, you know, consecutive naming format, you know, so they're trying to figure out which one's the current one. It's a mess all across the board.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember a small publisher who I won't name, who actually published an earlier version. Not the latest one. And I don't know if they ever correct that. I don't think they could.
That's a stab and offense right there. That's stabbing. Yeah.
Yeah.
No question.
There was that humorous mug you used to be able to get for a writer that had your Word document names on it. Do you remember that said final, 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 final. This is the final, final one.
That's right.
Final version three, final version four.
I will say this. And people have done this successfully, but I've had nothing but bad luck trying to share a Scrivener file for co-authoring or whatever. It goes sideways fast. So. Right.
Again, there's an Atticus gap in the market there.
Get that there you done. Go.
Absolutely. Okay. Awesome. JD, who is up next week?
Next week, we've got Nick Cutter coming back. He's the author of some of my favorite horror novels, The Troop, The Deep, The Handyman Method. His latest is called The Queen, and it releases October 29th. Nick Cutter.
Sounds great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.